Hello, everyone. This is Todd Wilson with the Lane 8 BMX podcast. And today, man, the name Todd Perry, I think, is synonymous with winning. And what I mean by that is, think about it. From the first race he ever did, 1978, 1-1-1. Who's done that? Not many people. Okay. You move on and he's winning his first national in Stockton, California. Goes on being the 2005 ABA world number one for Vet Pro, correct?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Okay. Okay. To winning over, think about it like this when I say winning, 150 national main events between 2010 and 2016 and becoming a world champ in 2017. And here's the crazy part. From 78 to 2024, this man has decided to come back for worlds. So my first question to Todd, TP Perry, why come back?
Wow, that's a good question. So I know that UCI doesn't have the worlds in the United States that often. I thought I was done racing after the 2016 season, and then I realized 2017 was going to be the world championship UCI would be here. You know, I'd considered racing it a bunch of times. It was just a huge commitment to fly to another country and be gone for as long as I'd have to be. You know, I had a wife and kids and a job, and it just never lined up for me. So 17 was an opportunity to do that. And then to be out of it for the last 7 years and to see that it was going to be again on U.S. soil. And I had an interesting conversation with Kaylin Young through wow. text message at the Grands. And I saw his name on the results at the Rock and told him congratulations. And me and Kaylin are pretty close. And he had said, hey, if you'll race the Worlds, I'll fly out and race it as well. So we kind of had that conversation. And so I told him, you're on. Let's do it. So I wrote up my program and started the 1st of December. And, you know, me and him have been texting back and forth, and hopefully we'll both be ready to lay it on the line in May.
Okay. A whole lot of questions that come to mind, when you decided, when you were talking there. First, I would have to say, from 2017 to 24, what were you doing?
A lot of golf. okay. A lot of golf, working, just enjoying my family. I made it out to a few locals. You know, there's a local racer, Bruce Ritter, who put on some 36 and over open type series. And, you know, if he poked me and prodded me enough, and he knows me well enough, when he tells me, I don't think he can beat these guys that are winning, then I'll show up and let's find out type of an attitude. So, I think I raced 2 state championship finals over those 7 years. You know, just on a whim, I'll just go out and ride. I like going out to the track every month or two, maybe, and at least getting in some hot laps, just for fun, just for practice, keeps me young. But as far as like any big races, nationals, anything like that, I didn't race any of those until this last January when I raced in Phoenix.
So. Yeah. Okay. You touched on it a little bit, but I'm curious. You put a program, you decided that you're going to come back. You put a program together. Yep. What has it taken you to come back? And in that 7 years, this is a two-parter. Has BMX changed much that you've had to adjust?
Well, first, I don't think it's changed much in the last 7 years. Honestly, I think it's pretty much the same style tracks. You know, there's not a whole lot different. And I'm comparing that to some of my other gaps, you know, from 1990 to 2001, it was way completely different from the tracks, a lot more jumps, a lot less pedaling. People were clipping in and not running flats. It was a big adjustment. It hasn't changed that much. As far as coming back, like I said, as much as I've raced, it's like I almost have to have a reason or a hunger or a drive to want to come back and race, right? I've raced a lot. I love the racing part. I just got over the travel and the things that I had to do, the sacrifices for my family, for me to be gone and whatnot. But once I'm at the track, I love being there. I love my competitors. I love racing. I love the competition. So having that conversation with Kaylin, and I'd kind of been, you know, pondering whether I could come back after 7 years. I'm racing the same class, but I'm 7 years older and haven't been riding. So I already know right off the bat, it's going to be a challenge. And then Kaylin gave me that last little push I needed to say, okay, let's do this. Let's, you know, go all in and write up a program and make it happen.
Is it more when you're coming back 7 years off, is it more muscle memory than anything?
Well, two parts. So one is the skill level comes back quick. I can go out and ride at the track for a couple hours and I can gain a ton of skill. You still have that muscle memory of feeling on how to manual, how to jump, how to do that stuff. Now, if you're not going as fast, it might be harder to jump and manual because you have to hold your manual longer. Yeah. And it is harder to jump. So, you know, speed and horsepower makes the track easier. So the horsepower factor is what's difficult, right? It goes away super quick. You know, your first straight goes away way quicker than you think. Yeah. And it takes time to build that up. You can't just do that in a month or 2 months. You know, I had like 5.5-ish months, which is still kind of cutting it short when it comes to actually gaining some real solid first straight horsepower or pull. So that's, you know, that's always the challenge. And that's, you know how BMX is. To me, that's the separator. Yeah. That's what separates people is the horsepower. At the highest level, everybody can ride a bike. Everyone has skill. Not saying that you don't make mistakes, but I'm just saying, you know, if everyone runs a perfect lap after the gate drops, who's going to win? Well, the guy with the most horsepower, because he's in the front. Yeah. So that's a two-parter, but I believe that's true for everyone skill-wise. You can make big gains in one day. Horsepower, it's going to take a while. So,
what about the mental aspect of it? Because you're switching on. You're not switching off. You're switching back on.
Yeah. To
race mode, train mode. Was that a smooth transition or was it difficult? You had your up and down days.
No, for me, it wasn't difficult. I mean, I've always been a very competitive person. Sure. And when you turn it on, you turn it on. And I'm not one who, you know, I'm not going to try to minimize a possible, you know, defeat or downfall by saying things like, well, I'm just going out there to have a little fun. And, you know, I really, you know, and try to minimize it. I mean, from day one, it's like, I'm going there to win, period. And that's the way I've always thought is I'm going to win and I'll do whatever it takes to try to win and I'll just make it happen. Sometimes you fall short. Sometimes there's somebody better than you. That's okay. But I'm not going to pre-event start to minimize a possible, you know, impact on myself by already building in some excuses. Like there are no excuses. If I'm in the gate, whether I'm healthy, hurt, sick, doesn't matter. I'm there to try to win, end of story. So that it wasn't hard for me to turn it back on.
Not bad, not bad. Was it tough to get your gait back?
No, not really. I believe, you know, personally, I think the gait start back with the old cadence, the ABA cadence, when you knew when the gait was going to drop. I think it was more of an art form and more of like a, I used to compare it to a golf swing. I was a slingshotter, honestly. And, you know, a lot of people complained about it. It's something that's very hard to learn. And just a lot of people with a lot of different techniques. For me now, at my age, honestly, my reaction time, when I hear the first beep, I'm a listener. I don't watch the lights. I listen. But when I hear the first beep, I go. And sometimes I'm still late. So it kind of took the whole, you know, technique as far as anticipating when you're going to hit the horsepower. Now, when I hear the first beep, I go. I've done so many gates. Once I go out to the track and do a few, it's not a problem for me at all. So
what type of bike are you riding this time around?
Well, I got two different brands. So I have my cruiser I'm riding is a Speedco. You know, Derek Betcher, he was kind enough to help me out and hook me up. And, you know, that was kind of through the Kaylin Young connection. He also rides Speedco and is good friends with Derek. And so I'm doing that on the 24. And then my 20 inch is a Gunslinger. You know, Lonnie Lyerly out of Las Vegas. He was cool enough. He hooked me up with a cruiser for the 2017 Worlds, which I won Worlds on his Gunslinger 24. And I love them both. My Gunslinger is an OS 20. which I think for me, honestly, was just an excuse to build another bike.
Yeah.
Cause you know, there's something new and I really love it. It's not that I can't ride a 20 inch bike. I can ride a 20 inch. I have 20 inch bikes and people at the local track know that I have like 15 bikes and I'll literally just grab a bike and, you know, I'll race my 2005. I have a 2003 Redline that I'll take out to the track and do hot laps on. So, I'm really not tied to one bike over the other. Most of them are about the same geometry anyway. So it takes like 5 minutes to figure it out. And, so the OS 20 thing, you know, a lot of people say it's way easier to ride and whatnot. Honestly, I don't notice a huge difference for me. That doesn't mean it's not a huge difference for somebody else, but, yeah. No, that's just the latest one that I built. So that's the one I've been racing in 20 inch and, we'll see what the future holds on those bikes after the worlds, you know?
Yeah. Are you particular when it comes to your setup?
No, not really. I mean, I've won, like I said, I got all those bikes. I have bikes with 175s, 177s, 180s. I'm not super picky. I mean, there's some things that I am. Like I like running a Holy Roller tire on the back. I know it's not the trendy, you know, speed type tire, but if I don't run one on the back, I tend to spin out of the gate. Might be only one out of every 10 times, but that's one time too many. So some stuff I'm particular about, but as far as like bike setup and stuff,
yeah,
I'm really not. I think like I ride a double XL 20 and all the way back to my Redline days in 2002, you know, all the way through from there to Supercross to GHP to SE to whatever, Extreme Team when I rode for Extreme Team, all those bikes are like 21 3/4 top tube, 11.5 inch bottom bracket. The chainstay you can make what you want based on your chain length. Yeah. So really, you know, I could build a bike tomorrow and a few laps and it's good. I'm good to go. So not super particular. I know some guys are. I know some guys could tell you, well, I know the bottom bracket's 1/4 inch lower or high. I'm kind of a meathead, just a horsepower guy. When the gate drops, I just go as fast as I can and try to get to the finish line first. So.
Okay. You said something that I'm interested in because you have one that's carbon and you have one that's aluminum. Do you notice the difference?
Well, my Speedco is aluminum actually.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. It's an aluminum frame. And I had that conversation with Derek Betcher. I've never ran a carbon frame.
Yeah.
And where I only had, you know, 5.5-ish months, whatever it was, I really didn't want to try to change. Everybody says you have to get used to it. Yeah. That's just one factor I wanted to take out of it. I don't think it would have bothered me. I think I would have been fine. Like I said, I'm not super particular, but you know, we'll just take that out of the equation. And I've always ran aluminum. So for this race, we'll just stick with the aluminum frame. I mean, I weigh 230 pounds. So I don't think a few ounces on the frame weight is really going to win or lose a race for me anyway. That's it. So it is what it is.
Training wise for you right now, are you heavy in the gym? Are you doing more track work? Where do you lean towards?
Well, I haven't done a lot of track work only because I live in Utah and our tracks aren't open yet. In fact, our first outdoor track doesn't open until May 7th, which is 2 days before I fly out. So, there's some in Southern Utah. I'm going to go race this next weekend. There's a couple state qualifiers down in Southern Utah. I'm going to race and hopefully we can maybe snake a few hot laps in over at Rad Canyon. You know, there's a couple guys that I know, that might be able to get me on there. Sean Kuhn, who runs a local team and he's involved in the track. You know, sometimes we can schedule a night. I know they've been good about in years past about like grands prep. Even when the track's closed, those that are going to grands will get you on the track. We'll get you some gates. So hopefully we'll have some world prep type practices. But at the end of the day, I'm not as concerned about that as going to the gym, doing my sprints, you know, building an engine. The engine's the most important part. I'll figure the rest out, right? I've already ridden on that track. I rode on it like a month ago. So I'm not concerned about the track itself. It's just going to be whether I have the horsepower to be up front or not. That's the question. So that's my focus.
Tell me this. When you get to a race, when you're getting to something like a Worlds or a National, How does your, what mode does Todd go into? Is it don't bother me, I've got to concentrate? Or are you more of the, you know, I'm friendly with everybody to keep it cool to be able to get on the gate?
Yeah, well, I mean, people talk about my grin, how I'm always grinning all the time. So I think I'm pretty pleasant, but there's definitely an edge to it. I wouldn't say that there was, but I know that my mom and my wife could tell me that, you know, probably the week of a big race and the weekend of the big race, I'm a little different in the sense that just a little bit of, you know, for me, just focus. Like, I don't want to be sidetracked with a bunch of stuff, but that doesn't mean, like, if you're at the Grands and you don't race for the next 4 hours, that you're not just totally, you know, goofing around and having a good time. And then when it comes time to go race, then you got to get, you know, everybody has a routine.
Yes.
And I'm kind of that way as well, where so many motos before, you know, I always want to warm up, do my thing, get my mental focus, and just kind of go through my routine. So the world's is a little different. I mean, I'm used to the Nationals and how they flow. When I did the Worlds in 17, it was a little different. And I think I raced 6 laps. I think the race was about 5 hours. So you're racing about every 45 minutes-ish, which is good in a way, because you get a rhythm going and you kind of get your program going. But it was a different feel and a different setting that I wasn't used to. Obviously, I know what it is now. But yeah, I'm not somebody who's super on the side of, you know, super hardcore, don't approach me, don't talk to me. I'm not that person. Maybe right before the moto I would be, but and then I'm also not somebody, and I know everyone's in a different place, and this isn't some kind of, you know, backhanded comment. I know some people are there just to experience and, you know, have fun and do the best they can. And maybe they don't have the time to put into training and different. So I'm not, you know, saying that as a slight, but some people obviously are more laid back about the outcome of the race.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, my makeup from when I was a kid, if I'm going to do something, I'm going to try to win. And, you know, I mean, there's been times where I race local races and other things where I literally don't even qualify on purpose because I just don't feel the need. I'm just out there to race and get some hot laps in, and I don't need to come in and, you know, take somebody's, you know, glory or their district points or their state quality, whatever it is. I just don't feel the need to do that. So I wouldn't say I'm always a win at all costs kind of guy, but at the big races, I'm there to win and I'm going to be focused about it. So
no, not bad. Do you, I'm real curious about this, considering how talented you are throughout your entire career, even now, do you study your opponents?
We'll be right back.
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we are the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
Not really. I mean, I watch like USA BMX now post the Nationals and stuff, and I'll go, you know, my YouTube channel always pulls it up. So I'll usually watch the mains and stuff, but I wouldn't say I study them per se. I mean, every race is different. Every variable is different. And, you know, until you actually race them, it's really hard to determine, you know, how you would go about it. I mean, I know there's certain people that I've raced a lot that, some you trust, some you don't. And that factors into how you ride a race. But, and then I would say maybe at when I'm at a race and I'm watching my competition, there might be some opportunities or places where you think you can make a pass. So I'm not saying I never do it, but I don't make it a point. I'm not at the Grands rushing over to watch my competition get in laps. I just feel like the only race that goes the way I envision it is I get the whole shot, I'm in first, and I win. That's the only one that turns out the way you think. Any other scenario you bring up, it's never going to work out that way. So that's what I focus on, is myself.
That's interesting, because my next question was, do you go into a race, rather it's, let's say, a national or worlds, with a plan?
Yeah, the plan is to win every lap, whole shot, and win from start to finish. That's the plan. That's always the plan, right? Now, sometimes you end up behind somebody. Okay, cool. I've raced people who I couldn't beat to the first turn. You know, I raced against Darren Mitchell. Darren Mitchell beat me to the first corner 99 out of 100 times. And usually if he didn't, it's because he had a problem. He was just that much better down the first straight. Yeah. Okay, fine. I will find a way to pass Darren somewhere. Sometimes I did, sometimes I didn't. But that was the plan with him. But, you know, it wasn't like I didn't try down the first straight because I figured he'd be in front. I still went full on, because if he had an issue, now I'm in first, right? So there were people that I raced that obviously had better first straights.
That's surprising.
I'm glad it wasn't many. You know, I got pretty good horsepower, and I could usually get out front in a lot of cases, which makes it way easier. But the plan always should be for everyone is get a good start, whole shot, and win from start to finish. That should be the plan.
Yeah. With all the experience that you have from all over the years that you've raced, is there anything that you think as a rider that you still need to work on?
There's always stuff to get better at, right? There's always something to work on. You're always, even if you're just working to stay sharp on skills you already have. I mean, I'm always about challenging myself. I'm always about getting out of my comfort zone and, you know, trying to, you know, manual two rollers in a row, even though I can get away with not actually, like, you know, pulling for a double to pull manual it, or, you know, just things that maybe at my age or should be gone, or I should have given up on those, where I like to challenge myself and try to get better. If I recognize that I'm deficient at something, that's fine. I think some people, honestly, they take a weakness, they spend so much time on that that they forget about what their strengths are, and then they actually do worse. So I know that my strength is get a good start, horsepower. Like I say, call me a meathead, call me whatever the term is. That's cool. I'll own it. That's me. But I have a lot more skill than some people want to give me credit for, because they want to put you in a certain category. You're either a meathead or you're a skill guy, and put you in that box. And, you know, I consider myself both. Are there guys that have a little more skill than me? Yeah, there are. But in some cases, just because you can manual the whole rhythm section doesn't mean you're going to do it in a race, and it's not an advantage. So during a race, how much skill do you have? Do you have enough skill to win to the finish line? And so right now, I don't have any glaring things that I need to work on. I just always try to be the best overall rider I can be, which means I work on everything. When I go to the local track, I work on gates. I work on jumping, manualing. You know, I'll take sections different ways on purpose, right? I'm pumping this whole section no matter what. I'm going to manual this whole section. I'm going to jump this whole section, whatever it takes, just to get you to practice all facets of the track, because you never know what the next track is going to be, and you might have to use one of those. So
I'm curious, Todd, how old are you right now?
56.
You're 56. That's what I thought I was going to say, but I wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
At 56 years old, how does your body respond? And do you notice the difference from being, let's say, 41 to 56? Do you notice how your body responds? And is it difficult for the day-to-day training? And what do you need to do to prepare for the next day?
Oh, yeah. 100%. And I would note, I would say that now at 56, I think I train probably more like you would want to train a 15, 16 year old kid, in a sense of longer recovery times. You know, we don't have teenagers doing massive amounts of squats and all kinds of stuff because they're young. And so you kind of bring that back a little bit. And I think a mistake that a lot of older racers make is they just overtrain, and you got to give your body a chance to repair and heal and actually make some gains before you tear it down again. And, you know, when I was 40, that year I was 40 on a 20, when I raced A Pro, when I was kind of checked out, just on the Vet Pro. I'd raced it for 7 years, I believe, and I just wanted something different. Just wanted to race a pro, go out and race the kids. No points, you know, none of that. Just love racing again. And I was 40 and I won some A-Pro national main events. So I could still train pretty hard at 40. Now 56, not so much. So I've toned it back a lot. So, I would just suggest people maybe, you know, I'll have conversations with people my age who I've raced against, who I'm friends with. And I suggest that, you know, and some people, sometimes less is more. You know, and it's built into us. Hey, if we're not getting it, we need to work harder. And sometimes the answer may be work less hard and let your body recover and get your small gains in horsepower and speed and whatnot. If you're going to the gym 5 days a week at 56, you're probably not going to get any stronger because your body never has a chance to recover. So I've had to try to factor that in. And obviously we don't have 100% proof of what's going to work because I've never been 56 before. So You're just trying to feel what your body feels. And if you feel strong, if you don't feel strong. So, that's what I would compare it to is I think I'm more like if I wrote a program for a, you know, 14, 15, maybe 16 year old. That's kind of what I do, which is less than what you're doing in your 20s, 30s, and even up to when you're 40, where you can have a pretty heavy workload. You can recover pretty fast. You're making gains pretty quick. I think at 56, the gains are slower, smaller, but just be consistent with it and give your body a chance to rest and you'll be fine.
Not bad. Great answer. This is the thing that I'm curious is how do you, as a man that has raced, let's say since 1978, you've had your time off, of course, but you still have a great love for the sport of BMX. And how do you maintain that?
Wow. I think it's just something that just gets, you know, the phrase, it's in your blood. It just becomes part of your DNA. Like I just, when I think back about what a random opportunity or chance, you know, my older brother had a friend who was going to go race. And so my older brother was going to go. And so then I decided I was going to go, which I'm sure wasn't a popular decision for my brother because I was always tagging along, you know. I had to borrow a helmet from his friend. It was a snowmobile helmet, had a big eagle on the side of it, and racing my Schwinn Scrambler. My mom will tell the story that I said I was going to race and she thought we were like racing around the neighborhood. And then I came home with a trophy. It was actually on my mom's birthday. So that's how I can always remember the day because it was on my mom's birthday in 1978. And just through, you know, through up till like 84 when I was 16, just, you know, the thing I really loved about the sport, honestly, I started to love it a lot more when I got in high school. And I did a lot of high school sports. I wrestled, I played football, I played on the high school baseball team. I was doing all that. And you get to see some of the politics that are involved in sports. And so I really started to love wrestling and BMX even more because, you know, when you get in that gate, whoever wins to that finish line is the winner, regardless of who your dad is, who your brother is, who your sponsor is, who some people say is the best. It none of that matters. What matters is I'm some kid from, you know, racing on a bike shop team from Utah and I just won. Right. I don't care if you have a factory sponsorship or not. So that's what I really loved about BMX. You can really create your own success by winning. And another factor that I like about it is that the things you have to do to win in BMX are not fun. And why I say that is going to the gym, doing squats, doing deadlifts, doing plow. That's not fun. Going to the trails is fun. I love going to the trails. I love going to the skate park. I love going to the ski resort and bombing down the hills on my mountain bike. Does that help you as a racer? Well, yeah, because you're building skill. But the difference maker, in my opinion, is horsepower. And doing sprints by yourself, especially in Utah when it's 30 degrees outside and you have to go out and do sprints and you have to do the stuff to separate, that's the stuff that matters. And I think that not everybody's willing to do it. So you have a chance to build your own success. And I've seen kids who, you know, couldn't even win a local race. And then 2 or 3 years later, they're winning main events at nationals. Why? Because they put in the work. You can honestly, you know, baseball, football, there's stuff you can do to be a better athlete, but you can't take batting practice by yourself. You can't catch passes by yourself. There's a lot of stuff you can't do by yourself. BMX, you can. You can build your own motor by yourself. You can ride your bike by yourself. So I really like that fact, even more so than wrestling, where you have to have a partner outside of conditioning and strength. But the actual skills of wrestling, you have to have a partner. BMX, 99% of it you can do on your own. So if you want to be good, go out and get it. Go out and work hard. Go out and make it happen.
Dude, I respect what you say, especially that part where it comes down to you.
Yeah. Because,
man, I did a lot of BMX when I was a kid, played a lot of football in high school and raced 10 speeds, rode bikes for a long time, come down to a sprint, and teammates don't want to work for you and all that. And then all of a sudden I got back into BMX at 40 something. And I was like, that's one of the main reasons why I love BMX, is because it's up to you. It's not anybody else. And rather, you have a teammate that's next to you in the gate. You never take out your teammate, but I damn sure want to beat him and everybody else.
Yeah. Oh yeah. 100%. I agree with that. And I think that's why most people do love the sport, is it's an individual sport, you know, in a world of, you know, everyone's a winner. Guess what? Everyone's not a winner in BMX. And
you
win or you don't. And I think there's a lot of life lessons in that, right? If you don't like the result, put in the hard work. And honestly, if I put in the hard work, and I've went to some big races and left disappointed that I didn't win, but the ones that I put in the hard work and I knew I did my program to a T and I put in all the hard work, I was okay with it. The process is a reward as well. You don't always have to have a win at the end to feel good and feel proud of yourself that, hey, I committed to this. I said I was going to win and I did everything I could, everything under my control to win. Sometimes somebody's just better and that's okay, right? Yeah. That's a life lesson. That's okay. But if you go to a race and you haven't trained and then you barely don't win, that's hard to swallow, because you know if you wouldn't have been lazy and put in the work, you would have won, right? So I love that about the sport. That's, to me, that's the best thing about the sport, is you can create your own success, right? Whether you're rich, poor, I mean, there's some factors money-wise. I know when I was young, you know, there was a time when I got co-sponsored by Diamondback after I made the main at the Grands in Oklahoma City in 12 Expert and got fifth. And I got a co-sponsorship, and they had called me and said, hey, there's a national down here in Texas. Come on down. We'll, you know, just get yourself down here. We'll pay your entry fees. We'll pay for you to stay, all this stuff. Well, you know, raised by a single mom with six kids, that wasn't going to happen. She couldn't afford for me to go down there. And so I didn't go. And I think, man, back then I didn't even train. I didn't know what training was. I just rode my bike around the neighborhood. I didn't know how to set up and do sprints, right? Well, I think, man, if I would have spent 5 minutes with Harry or Eddie King or any of those guys, I'm sure they would have asked me, what are you doing? And like, you need to do A, B, or C. How much better could I have been? And everybody has those kind of stories, right? Everybody had those shoulda, coulda, woulda type stories. But so I know money can be a factor, but bottom line is you put the work in. If you're winning every race, I promise you, you will get an opportunity somewhere by somebody. So
that is very true. That is very true. Did you know in 1978, after that first race, that BMX was your sport?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I loved it. I loved the experience. I mean, who wouldn't? I won, right? Yeah. If I would have went there and got freaking waxed off the track and got last, maybe it wouldn't have been my sport. But you know, up to that point, it's nothing that I did. I didn't work hard for it or anything. I just was gifted. I was, you know, blessed that, you know, that I was a good athlete, right? God blessed me with the genes and whatever. And I was always super fast running, you know, sprinting wise, ran track as a kid and whatnot. So I think it just transferred over to the pedals. And, I was probably a year or so into it. I went and raced the ABA Grands in Las Vegas in 1979, and I got third. Utah had just became affiliated with the ABA, and back then they had novice and expert, and I was novice because we just started. Back then you could only win four races, and they made you expert. But I raced novice, and I got third at that at that Grands. And after that, I think I realized I have a lot of talent for this sport and I really want to do good at it. And I started to, you know, think of getting a factory sponsorship or trying to be a big time racer, right? With all the magazines coming out. And like I say, 1980, go to Oklahoma City, hitched a ride with a friend from Provo, Chad Sollenbach. His dad was a doctor. We threw bikes on top of his Mercedes and off we go. Seemed like we drove for 3 days. And, you know, here I am, just a 12-year-old kid. No direction, nobody helping me with my gear, my bike set up, nothing, go to the Grands. And I was on the bubble all day, honestly. Like, I was on the bubble in eighth main, quarter main, semis. Like, I was the last one to make it, but I made the main and I got fifth in the main, which is amazing to me because, like I said, I didn't have anybody mentoring me or helping me. And again, so after that year, I think there was only two of us, me and Mike Polson, that made the main at that Grants. And Mike Polson, he was big time at that time, right?
Yeah.
You know, he was everybody's from Utah's hero. We never got to see Mike that often because he was always racing the national circuit, but he was a great, great racer. And it was fun to hang out with him when I was a kid. I did a book. I don't know if you ever saw BMX Racing Fever. They did a little book with an audio tape and everything, and he was the feature, but I got to be a extra per se. So I was in there in some of the pictures and whatnot, but so it probably took me a couple years to realize that I was really talented and I really wanted to succeed in the sport.
Yeah. What was racing like in Utah at that time? How many tracks did you have? Were you racing a lot during the week or all the time on weekends?
Yeah. I didn't race a lot, but that was only probably because, like say, because of the financial situation with my mom.
Yeah.
But we had quite a few tracks. I'm going to guess we probably had four or five. We had one in Ogden. We had a couple in Salt Lake. We had one in Provo, which was my home track. And for a time, they had one down in St. George, which is Southern Utah. So we had plenty of options. You could race multiple, you know, almost every day of the week if you wanted to. But I usually just race the Thursday night Provo races. And then, you know, every couple, 3 weeks, I might go up to one of the Salt Lake tracks and race up there. But
Not bad. Okay, you got to 84, and it seems like you ended up leaving the sport.
Yeah.
Why?
Just 16, you know, school, sports.
You got the fumes is what you got.
Yeah. Bought my first vehicle. I bought a Jeep CJ5 and, yep, you know, wanted a girlfriend and just all the distractions that come with being 16.
Yep.
And none of my, you know, peers raced. And so it was hard to, you know, I raced through that summer when I was 16, did really well. And I would say I was late on the puberty curve. When I was 14, I really struggled. And I don't even know, honestly, if I won a local race the whole year. Like, really? I struggled. And I was just super small. I went into high school as a freshman. I think I wrestled 112 as a freshman. I was like 5'2". Yeah. Yeah. You know, fast forward, when I graduated, I was almost 6'1", 195. But my 16-year-old year, I got really strong. Like, I hit the puberty curve and I got strong. And down at the local track in Provo, we had a few pros from Utah, yeah, A pros. And I prided myself, like, nobody could beat me to the first corner at the Provo track. And looking back, I thought I was way too young to turn pro. I mean, who turns pro at 16? Not knowing the history of Greg Hill and Eric Roop and all these guys who did, yeah, I was thinking more like, you know, you don't turn pro till you're 18, 19. You know, looking back, I should have just turned pro and I didn't. And like I said, just all the distractions. So I stopped racing and just focused on high school and wrestling and playing football and whatnot.
So. Not bad. You came back in 1990.
Yeah.
You're 22 years old. What was the catalyst to get you back in?
Well, it was actually kind of like this world's story we were talking about. I worked with a guy who I used to race with, and he kind of challenged me. He said, I know you used to beat me when we were kids, but you're way too big to ride a BMX bike now. Cause I was pretty big. And I mean, I lifted a lot of weights. And like I said, I was probably over 200 pounds. And so it was like, let's do it. So we went and signed up for one of our indoor races. Back then it was 17 and over still. And I signed up for expert. I'd raced expert. I was going to race expert. And he decided he didn't want to, I think based on his practice laps and kind of how he was feeling. So he ended up signing up for intermediate. And I won the 17 and over expert, which nobody knew who I was because I'd been gone for quite a while. Right. But that kind of started my second stint in racing. And like I said, I'd raced a few months and I won a national in Stockton, California. The next day was the famous mud race with all the straw and Sean Texas getting up to the gate with a micro mini and basically just sprinting the whole track and just dusted everybody. Just some funny stuff that happened that weekend. But, and then I won another national in Salt Lake. Felt really fast. I know Keomi Waller, he was like the one to beat in my cruiser class, 21 to 25. I was looking forward to racing him at the Gold Cup Championship that fall. Unfortunately, I had a big crash at my local track in August of that year and destroyed my knee. And the doctor said, you'll never race again. You'll never compete in any sports again. I had my ACL and PCL replaced with cadaver tissue and whatnot. And so I just kind of took it on the chin as my racing career was over. And I still did other stuff. I still played like city league softball and I still was active, still went to the gym and all that. But I figured that my BMX career had came and gone, you know, and just kind of moved on.
So. Wasn't there a situation where he even said that you may not even walk right again?
Yeah. He said I'd be lucky to walk without limping. And, you know, it was serious enough that he'd mentioned that, you know, if it had happened so many years before, they're not even sure that they could fix it. And, you know, talked about that people in the past had had amputations and whatnot, because literally the only thing holding my leg together was my inside hamstring and my MCL on the inside. Everything else from my patella tendon to my hamstring, MCL, PCL, ACL, they were all in half. So I did quite a number on it. So, and people were like, how did you do that race in BMX? Well, I'll tell you how. I hit a double, me and a guy hit going over a double. You figure the double was probably, you know, 6-7 feet above the ground. I was probably another 4 feet above that. So you're talking 10 or 11 feet from where I was and to where I landed. When we hit, it kind of kicked me sideways. So I made the decision to bail off. So I bailed off my bike and I was doing the running man in the air, trying to keep my balance and try to get straight so I could land. And my right foot hit first. And like I say, people that I worked with used to kind of say, how could you do that on a bike? And I would tell them, go home, get up on your garage, run as fast as you can, jump off the roof and land on one foot and then see what happens. Cause that's basically what it was. Right. And then they can kind of perceive like, okay, if you're 10, 11 feet off the ground, you're going 20 plus miles an hour, you jump and you land on one leg, that's probably not going to end well. Right. So it was serious, but looking back, you know, I wouldn't change anything. I, you know, race the way I race and I'm always trying to win. And that case, it kind of bit me and it just happened. And I mean, everything that happens to us makes us who we are, right? Yes. My BMX career is different than most because that happened and I had that huge gap. Yeah. Never thought I would race again, but I did, fortunately.
Okay, so. I got to go back to that because I'm curious. You're racing, you're 22 years old and you're on a hot streak. You're starting to get more momentum. And then all of a sudden it comes to an end.
Yeah.
So how do you handle that especially if you don't mind me saying, you're a young man, you're 22 years old. How do you handle that?
Not very good. Not very good. Like you say, you're young, you're immature. As a kid, like I said, I always felt like I was good enough to have this big time sponsorship, factory sponsorship support to really be able to showcase my talents. I couldn't. Part of it because of the financial situation, not being able to get to big races and whatnot. But now at 22, I have my own job. I have my own money. I was racing for Body Belt at the time. Bob Lunick, rest in peace. Love Bob. He was local and he hooked me up on his team, on his Body Belt team. And I'd already told him I'm going to finish out this year and I'm going to turn pro and I'm going to try to win the national overall cruiser title. And however that turns out, I'm going to turn pro. And I had two pros at the local track. Joey May, who was super successful, and I watched him podium at a bunch of nationals I was at. Fuzzy Hall, who I also watched podium at nationals I was at. Down the first straightaway at, you know, the local track, I could beat them the majority of the time. They might have a different memory of that, but my memory, I had a ton of horsepower. I knew I had the power to compete in the pro class. And so I said, hey, I'm going to finish out this year and turn pro. So it was very disappointing for me. I mean, I remember leaving the hospital. My mom picked me up. I was married at the time, but still pretty young. And my mom picked me up, and I like cried all the way home because I was just so disappointed that I, again, wasn't going to have an opportunity to take my place and to prove how much talent I had for the sport. I thought, why did this have to happen? You know, but again, I was able to rectify that. And even though I had to take the long way around, I think I've proved that I do have talent for the sport. So
even at 56, to be very honest with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So you're dealing with that. How did you get, what did you do from that point on? Obviously the rehab and everything, but I mean, just life in general. How did you go from that?
I just, like I said, I went to the gym. I had my once a week softball. I played with a lot of my high school buddies. And even though I was kind of gimpy, I couldn't run real good. I was still out there. I had to go play first base and whatnot, but I just worked and just became a family man and just tried to be the, you know, a good husband and a good father. My son, oldest son, was born in 94. My other son in 97. I just lived a normal everyday life that, you know, the American dream. I bought a house when I was about 24, 25, bought a house. So just, you know, living the dream and, thinking, you know, talking about how good I used to be or how good I could have been. And, obviously, you know, that, in end of 2000, my oldest son that saw my trophies, he wanted to go race. So I took him to the local track and he had a little small soldier 16 inch bike. And that kid, he just did lap after lap after lap, like he wouldn't stop. And he wanted to race. And I went and bought him a little Redline Mini. And, you know, the rest is kind of history. You can only, if you got it in your blood and you really love it, you can only stand on the side of the track and watch for so long. And then I justified it by saying, hey, you know, I'll just practice. I'm just going to practice with my son. I'll just ride. And then after I do for a while, you know, it's like, yeah, maybe I should sign up and race because I'm going pretty fast. Right. So that kind of turned into me racing in 2001. And it was pretty much a dream season. I didn't understand what the points were. Honestly, I went into the grands with 5 wins and a second. I didn't really know how the points worked, didn't care. And I won the grands. I think Jarrett Kolich got national number one cruiser, and I believe Donnie Robinson got number 2, and I was number 3. But I was only 18 points out, which if I would have had another first, 40 points, I would have been the overall, which, you know, I didn't really know. I was just having fun racing, right? I won the Redline Cup. I won the Rock. I won on both bikes. I got Nag One on both bikes. Like, after not racing for that many years, like it was a dream season. And so I decided, hey, I always wanted to be a pro. I'm turning pro. And I had a lot of people discourage me, believe it or not. Really? A lot of people. Why? Say, dude, just stay amateur, you know, try to win a cruiser title. You know, those guys in that pro class, they've been double A for years. You'll never beat those guys. Just be happy when an amateur, just, you know, a lot of trying to be positive about it. I think they thought they were doing me a favor because they honestly probably believed I wouldn't be able to beat the likes of Eric Roop and Jason Karnes and Barry Nelson and the rest of those guys in there, Eric Dyer and, you know, Leary and, you know, a lot of guys that were my heroes growing up. But I wanted to do it and I wanted to find out. And it took me a minute. I didn't go right in there and make a main event. I didn't even get out of motos for a couple nationals. Then I'd make semis, not make the main. Then I'd make the main and I'd get, you know, 6th or 7th. And it took me a while to get on a podium. I did get on some podiums my first year, but I didn't win a race in Vet Pro until my 3rd year. Took me my third season to actually win an overall. And it was at the Ontario, California track. So I always did good at that track. I don't know why, it just loved me, I guess.
So bad. Okay, I've got to ask you this then. Going from winning the Rock Redline Cup, two nags, to going into not making mains, not even getting out of motos, not even making the box.
Yeah.
How did you handle that mentally? Because I would say that physically, you're probably just as good as they are, but it's just a whole different game, ball game, because one, you're racing against guys that are paying mortgages. They got families. You do too, but you have a job.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, how did you handle that mentally?
Well, the losing part wasn't that difficult. I mean, it was just more fuel. No, it was just more fuel to the fire. I knew that eventually I would be able to win, and it just gave me more determination to train hard and do my sprints. And I always tried to minimize the impact of my family. So I would go to the gym at 10 o'clock at night after my kids went to bed. I would do sprints at 10 o'clock when my kids went to bed. And sometimes you're just tired, but if you really want it, then you're going to go do it. But the hardest thing for me racing in that class early, honestly, was just getting over the fact of who I was racing against. That was hard.
Yeah.
Right. Racing Harry and racing Roop. And, you know, I got a couple of years later, I raced Greg Hill and, you know, I raced Pete Longkarevich and Billy Griggs and John Purse. I raced a lot of people in Vet Pro who were my heroes and were, you know, they're all Hall of Famers. Right. So that was hard for me to get over. In fact, I had Harry, you know, Harry got all that flack for what happened at the Grands. I've done the same thing. Now, he felt like that somebody did something to him and he wanted to pay him back. You can debate whether somebody did or didn't. That's really, you know, maybe something happened before that. People always want to focus on the act. Well, maybe that's been building up for the last four nationals. You don't know that.
Yeah.
But I know there was a time, and I'm going to say this in Harry's defense, because I passed him in Phoenix in a turn and I went under him. And I didn't touch him and I didn't really cut in front of him at all. I just passed him. And after the finish line, he came over and he said, "Hey, don't ever do that again." And I said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "I know you took it easy on me in that turn and you didn't bump me. And I don't appreciate it because you know what? I will bump you when I pass you. So don't do that to me again." So to his defense, he expects everybody to do what they need to do to win. He doesn't hold it against him. In fact, he takes it as an offense if you don't move up in the turn and take the spot, right? I didn't because, I mean, it's Harry. I'm not just going to go in there and blast him. Yeah. And he was offended by that. So he's not one who's just going to dish and not receive is what I'm trying to say. So there's a lot going on. And I know I've had my issues. You know, me and Jason Carnes went at it more than once. And I took a lot of flack at the Grands in 05 when I blasted him in the last turn. That was building up for way longer than that race, right? That'd been building up for a while. And if you go back and watch the video, the rhythm section leading up to the last turn, he was in the center and I was already on the white line on the inside and I was passing him. He cut over so hard, tried to run me into the hay bale. There's a picture of me down with my elbow out and his butt's hitting my elbow and he's half sideways because he came over so hard to cut me off. So at that split second, it's like, okay, you want to hay bale me? I'm going to try to blast you. It wasn't like a pre-thought out, like I'm going to crash him. It was a split second decision, which still looking back, I feel was earned. And I'm sure he would tell you that there was a lot more to it than just what happened in that split second. So I'm thinking that the Harry, you know, Charlie Williams, I don't know him that well. He's a great guy. I met him in Rock Hill, a lot of respect for him and what he's done and what he's accomplished. But I'm just saying that there's probably more to the story. And you know, Harry has some good about him as well. So that's all I'm saying.
I think a lot of people in Harry's situation, I think Harry didn't help himself with some of the comments, but also I think there's a lot of Monday morning coaches, you know what I mean? That will tell you how you should handle that in that situation. But none of them have probably ever been in that situation.
Yeah. So, and it's easy for us to Monday morning quarterback. I mean, we do it in other sports, right?
Yes, sir.
Quarterback throws an interception and you're like, why did he do that? What was he? Well, we've never been a quarterback in the NFL. We don't understand the pressures, but it's easy to criticize. And, you know, Harry's a very intense racer. You know, I can sympathize with that. I'm the same way. You know, there was a unnamed racer. I would race down in, it was out in San Bernardino, I believe. And I think I got a first and a second in the first two mains. And the next one closest to me, I believe, was Carnes. And he had 5 or 6 points. I had a cushion is what I'm saying. Yes. And I went into the first turn in second in the third main. And this dude, he got seventh and eighth in the first two mains. And he bumped me in the hip. I couldn't see him. He was behind me. He came up and hit me in the hip and shot me up the turn into the soft stuff. And I almost went over the handlebars, saved it. Took off. I ended up getting like fifth in the main. Carnes won it, cost me the overall. I wasn't happy about it. When I went through the finish line, I didn't even hit my brakes. I flat out just T-boned him as hard as I could. I was mad, right? I told him, dude, NASCAR analogy, you're a lap down. You don't crash the leaders as they go by. Supercross, blue flag, you don't get in the way of the leaders. You have 15 points. You're a lap down. Why are you running into me in the first turn? So, you know, you can argue whether it was justified that I blasted him or not, but I don't know that you would argue that I wasn't justified being upset that someone who has 15 points felt the need to hit me in the turn and yeah. shoot me up the turn and cost me the overall for the day, right? Yeah. And at that time, it was probably 05, 06-ish. I mean, I was up. That's when I was contending for the titles. Like, every win mattered, right? Every win mattered. Yeah. So, like I say, not 100% defending Harry, because I'm not sure what all the backstory is, but there are things that happen, like you said, that people don't know. They've never been in that situation. They can say they would react in a different way, but if they've never been in the situation, how do they really know, right? Exactly. So exactly. Give a guy a break, and just think that maybe you don't know everything. You don't know what the backstory is. So
right. Okay. 2002. Rode for Factory Redline, ended the year 5th, ABA Worlds number 2. 2003, Redline, ended the year 4th, ABA Worlds number 3. 2004, Supercross, ended the year 4th, ABA 2. 2005, Vet Pro, Supercross, ended the year number 2 equals to Worlds number 1. Yeah. Okay, I'm thinking it's obvious what you can see from the time that you turned Vet Pro. It was pure progression.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that something you have to have in your racing?
Something that you hope to have, obviously. Yeah. And Vet Pro is interesting too, because we always had new people coming in.
Exactly.
You know, everybody thought Vet Pro wasn't that hard, right? I know that I had an opportunity to race Charles Townsend, who I have a ton of respect for. And I know that the announcer was calling him the track sweeper, because he had made the comment he would sweep the track before he raced Vet Pro. But then he raced Vet Pro. Yeah. But it's a lot harder than people think, right? Yeah. So to progress or get better every year was great, but I wasn't racing just the same people. There were people coming in. I remember Chris Hamm came in, Darren Mitchell came in. You know, I say Charles Townsend came in, Matt Hayden came in. Like, every year we would get these guys who were seasoned double A's coming into Vet. And so even just to keep the same number was an accomplishment. But I used to always tell Eric Roop, I had this little saying, and I would tell him, I say, the more things change, the more they stay the same. I'm not giving up my spot. I don't care who comes in this class. Right. If I got to up my game, I'll up my game. But I did not want to go backwards. Right. And it got harder and harder the older you get. I mean, the last year I raced in there, I was 39. And obviously the age is 30 and up. So you're giving up 9 years. And a lot of these guys are, like I say, right out of double A. It's hard. It's hard to compete with that. Right.
Yeah, I agree. You ended up leaving Supercross and going to GHP. Why did you leave Supercross?
That's an interesting story. I got a ton of respect for Bill. Bill was great to me. Love Bill. But after the 2005 Grands, I was 32 points down going in. So basically whoever won out of me and Jason was going to be the title holder. And I'd won quite a few races that year. And there was weekends. I say that ABA Worlds in Ontario, it's on tape. I dominated. I won every main at the pre-race, and I won every main at the World Championship race. There were weekends where I was by far the best guy there. I knew I was good enough to win the title, right? I didn't get wins because I was lucky or this or that. Jason obviously won 6 in a row. He had an amazing career, and I had nothing but respect for the guy. But I was a little frustrated after the 05 Grands, the way it all turned out, the way it ended, and I'd had a conversation with Greg Hill on the phone, and just through our conversations, just about racing in general and life and training and different things, I felt like it was just the right move for me to go race for Greg and learn from Greg and let Greg kind of be my mentor and be there for me racing wise. And he was just starting his company out again. They only had chromoly frames. I didn't even have a double XL. He had to get one custom made for me. And I always say I'm the last one to win a pro race on a chromoly frame. I don't know if that's true or not, but I was racing a chromoly frame that year when chromoly was long since gone. Right. And, I actually sent that frame to Eric Spears over there at Truth BMX. He wanted it and I sent it out to him. So he actually has that frame, nice. But, he's a good dude as well. So that's why just the value of, you know, and Greg's like a brother to me. I mean, we're still very close. I talk to him all the time and, I can't thank him enough for that opportunity. And Greg was one of those who had so much experience racing. I felt like, you know, Bill, he did a ton for me. Great product, great, you know, support, all that. But as far as like racing insight, that the knowledge that Greg had, you just couldn't put a price tag on that. And, you know, it was true. I learned a ton from Greg and I even got better. 2006, I even had a better, you know, 05 and 06 than I did after I left Supercross. So I think I proved that I made the right decision.